I'm Jamie Hurst, and for the MSU Denver Alumni Association, we're excited to bring you Bird Talk, a podcast about our alumni, their careers, and their lives.
Season 3 of Bird Talk is taking flight. This is President Davidson, and I am thrilled you are joining us as we explore the lives of MSU Denver alumni who are breaking boundaries, building communities, and blazing trails in their fields. These are the stories that prove how powerful and excellent the Roadrunner experience can be.
My last name is pronounced Keg. Keg of beer.
Exactly.
When I worked for the Navy, I worked in a residential drug and alcohol treatment program on a team with a Dr. Beers. And I thought, who's playing this cruel joke on these poor sailors struggling with alcohol with Dr. Beers and Mr. Keg? I was like, that's just not nice.
Today's guest is Xander Keg, a 1999 graduate with a degree in speech communications. Xander is an award-winning social worker, educator, and speaker whose work in emotional well-being and caregiving is making a lasting impact. As the co-founder of the LGBTQ Caregiver Center and host of the Umbrella Hour podcast, Xander brings a wealth of experience in conflict resolution, mental fitness, and social care. With a background spanning clinical social work, theology, and interpersonal communication, and a long list of accolades, including the NASW 2020 Social Worker of the Year, Xander's unique journey as a first-generation Latino American and neurodivergent leader gives him a powerful perspective on advocacy and change. In all things he does, Xander is a community builder and leader. He is committed to justice for transgender people and has ran a zigzaggy road that includes service in the United States Coast Guard, working at the Department of Veteran Affairs and U.S. Navy as a social worker, and authoring The Third Space, A Nonconformist Guide to the Universe. Xander was recognized by MSU Denver as the 2011 Alumni of the Year, and again as a distinguished alumnus in 2016. Xander, this is an episode I've been eagerly awaiting as I want to learn all of the things. So welcome to Bird Talk.
Thank you very much, Jamie. It's not just nice to be here. It is an honor to be here because, as I'm sure we'll talk about, other than the last 23 years I've spent with my wife, my time at Metro State, as I call it, you can let me know if I need to say something else.
No, you call it what you call it.
I'm old school. Was probably one of the best times in my life as a non-traditional student. It was phenomenal. So it's just an honor to be able to be back again involved with the school in any way possible.
Awesome. Well, I couldn't thank you enough to be able to share this time with us. And I'm so glad to hear that because that is what this podcast is about. We like to talk about the impact that MSU Denver had on our students and now alumni lives and the important role that it plays in a lot of the connecting of dots of other experiences that people have had in their lifetime that they didn't know they needed to form some sort of kind of nucleus until they got to MSU Denver. So I think your story lends itself well to that.
Perfect.
So we talk a lot here about MSU Denver's flexibility as an institution and willingness to meet people on their zigzaggy paths, right? Our president, Dr. Davidson, says that all the time. And as I was doing my deep dive and preparing to have this opportunity to chat with you, you've lived a lot of life and you've traveled a very zigzaggy path. And so I would love to just briefly run through at least what I've learned of you. So it may not be entirely true or in the correct order, but just to give our listeners an idea about this truly unique perspective you bring to the conversation. And then we can kind of pick and choose the things that you want to highlight and talk about, as well as really getting into your MSU Denver space. But I'm going to need a deep breath for this because this is a lot of things. Okay, so Xander, you were assigned female at birth, where you were born to a father in the Marine Corps and a mother that owned a psychic and tarot shop by day and produced drag shows by nights. Already, millions of questions that I'm so excited to talk about, right?
Yes.
They were
divorced most of my life. So
right?
Two different households, but yes.
Two households. Spent your early childhood between LA and Phoenix areas. Then you spent some years in a handful of different behavioral institutions where you were subjected to conversion therapy. Dropped out of high school at 17 and moved to Utah. You then enlisted in the United States Coast Guard. You served for 2 years before an injury forced your discharge. After the Coast Guard, this is my favorite nugget that I found. You worked as an undercover narcotics agent and then a liaison with the Northern California School District. Then made your way to Colorado and started your studies here at MSU Denver, earning your degree in speech communications. You did a bunch of things here that we'll chat about a little bit later, but most importantly, really getting the LGBTQ Center off the ground and starting the AQUA program. Around 30 years old, you began to acknowledge your transness and then started your medical transition at 39. You picked up a handful of degrees along the way as well, a master's in conflict analysis and resolution, a master's in theology studies from Pacific School of Religion, and then a master's of social work from San Diego State. He then managed to pack in an award-winning social work career, supporting and advocating for the trans community specifically. You're recognized as a transgender subject matter expert by the National Association of Social Workers, Veterans Health Administration, and Bureau of Navy Medicine and Surgery. Then, as if that wasn't enough, you co-founded the LGBTQ Caregiver Center, which is focused on holistic wellness, education, and services for caregivers after being the sole caregiver for your father. And then you launched the Third Space Press, wrote a book about overcoming obstacles and living life to the fullest, and are the host of the Umbrella Hour podcast that examines the lives of LGBTQ people from diverse vantage points. That's a lot of things, Xander. You don't look that old.
I know. I'll be 59 in 3 short months.
My goodness. So
it is a lot to pack in. And, you know, I remember in my 20s, people used to say, every time I hang out with you, I learn something new about you. You should write a book. Or how do you know these things? And I'd be like, I don't know. And then as I got older and older, people were like, it's like you're 5 different people. And I don't have a dissociative disorder. I don't have, or multiple personalities, as we might refer to it in the old days. It's, I don't know. I mean, I have attention deficit disorder, so I'm just probably,
easily bored.
Yeah, I just move around a lot. I don't get bored. That I don't move because I'm bored. I get into something, I do it for a while, and then I move on.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about things and people and places, and that keeps me going. I don't know. Yeah. And it's funny to think of all the things that weren't mentioned. Like, there's so much more.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so bizarre to think about it that way.
And again, I know there's more. And I always hate to present someone's life story to them in a truncated way that's like, actually, you missed out on these really important things. Like, I didn't mention your wife because I know we'll talk about her in a bit. Yeah. But there's a lot of incredible things in that space. But I do. I see so many commonalities, I think, just between the way you live your life and the way that I've lived mine as well, with this curiosity that just drives everything. Because people will say that to me all the time. I collect information and knowledge because I never feel satiated, right? And so I similarly have degrees that span all sorts of weird things, right? I have a religion degree. I have a sport management degree. I've got a law degree. I've got a public relations degree.
Yeah.
Because it's just like I find something and I'm like, oh, I want to know more about that and understand why that happens and how that can be applicable to whatever's next, right?
Yes. Like me, you're a systems thinker, right?
Very much.
And when you're a systems thinker, because I did a stint in law school. And then I decided, this reminds me too much of law enforcement people, and I didn't like them much, so I left. We have very similar overlaps. My degree is in speech. It's in interpersonal communication specifically, but I started as a public relations major.
Yeah.
So
it is. For me, I think my dad used to ask me this all the time before he passed, like, what's next, Jamie? You never stop. And not in a negative way, but I think he was physically tired of all the things that I did. Like, just even hearing about it, like it definitely aged him and made him so tired.
Yeah.
I was forced, I think, around the time that he passed to sit back and just be like, let me try and make sense of this in a way that would have made sense to him. And it was a very therapeutic, like, kind of response and activity that no one told me to do, and I kind of figure it out as I go, but to try and connect the dots between how I started as a very tomboy kid, very similarly playing t-ball and then playing baseball with the boys until they kicked the girls out of the league, to then earning a degree in religion and then going to law school and then coming to a place where now my passion is just to provide opportunities for people that otherwise may not have someone looking out for them. And I've been here 12 years doing that. And so it took me being very thoughtful and sitting down to say, how can I connect these dots so somebody who doesn't live in my brain can understand that it actually does make sense?
Well, that was really the catalyst for why I wrote my book, because my dad's, you know, the last 5 years of his life, he was struggling with dementia. I was his only family caregiver. And, you know, my father also lived a very, very rich life. He captured a segment of it on a blog post that he wrote back in 2012. I guess not a post, like a blog, right?
Yeah.
Called 100 Days for the Corps, CORPS, for Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. He did a cross-country trip on this contraption called an elliptigo. It's like an elliptical, but with wheels So it's a stand-up bicycle. And he flew to South Carolina and took off from the Parris Island Marine Corps Recruit Depot and rode all the way across to the San Diego Marine Corps Recruit Depot to celebrate like the 50th anniversary of his enlistment. I mean, you know, more adventurous than me in that way. And so he captured a lot of that story, but there was so much of his story that he never did capture. And I thought, well, maybe I want my life to be captured and something I want to be able to share it with my father. And so thankfully I was able to do some of that. It was published a month and a half after he passed, but he knew as much as he could understand, you know, throughout those years of what I was up to. It, you know, the another thing that makes me think of is on my graduation day, my dad flew out from San Diego to Denver, and the gift that he gave me was this little block. I'm looking around because I thought it was right in front of me. It's actually over there, but it's this little chunk of metal, and engraved on it is, "What would you do if you knew you wouldn't fail?"
Ugh.
That was his gift to me. And, it's touching me as I'm relaying the story, the memory. And so I don't remember what I said, but I remember what he said when I said, "What would you do, Dad?" And he said, "I'd live my life more like you've lived yours."
Hmm. That's the best thing a parent can ever say to their child.
Yeah. And that was what, 30 years ago?
Yeah.
Almost.
I love that. And I have the chills here. And again, it has nothing to do with you, but today is actually the third anniversary of my dad's death. Yeah. So I've already been in like a space where I've been very just thoughtful and aware of that. And like, and he died suddenly. So it, he wasn't well, but he was not in a position that we thought he was going to pass. And so it was very quick and a phone call. And then all of a sudden you have to go into like figuring out what that means for your mom and all that kind of stuff. And so I've just been very aware of it this morning. And so whether or not we were planning on talking about your dad or what that would look like, I just personally appreciate that you were vulnerable in that moment, because it just made me feel like, I don't know, it just felt like a hug all the way from across Florida. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Yeah.
That's incredible. So many things, but I do love that it sounds like there's been this consistency of either your awareness or your dad's awareness that living a full life is something that is very important. And if we did approach things with this attitude of, if you're not going to fail and you can just try something and there's no consequences, what would you do? So as I go back and I think through that gigantic list of, you know, some of the things that you've accomplished in life and done in life, what are the things that you think required the most of you to come together and say, okay, if I can't fail and I got to do this, now's the time to do this?
Well, when I was nearing the end of my first graduate program, the Conflict Analysis and Resolution program, I was encouraged to apply for the PhD program. And I thought, okay, why not? You know, so I applied and I was accepted. And then right as I was about to make the decision to register into that program, I remembered an experience that I had while I was in Denver, while I was attending Metro State. I had been staffing a booth at Pride across the street from the Capitol for the GLBT Student Services Office, which is what it was called back then in the 90s. And I was on my way home because I lived in Capitol Hill near Queen Super, if people understand the reference. And so I was going to walk up the street, Colfax, and I was walking past the Capitol. And this gentleman walked up to me and handed me this little comic book, right? These were these little like comic tracts that were from very conservative, evangelical, Protestant churches that were, you know, "You're a sinner, you're going to hell" kind of comic book. So not very funny or uplifting.
Comic. Yeah, it's comical.
Yeah, yeah. And so I took it and I looked at it. And for some reason, in that moment, I decided, you know what? I'm not going to just walk away. I'm not going to call the person a bad name. I'm not going to curse at them. I'm going to actually engage this person in a conversation. And I had sort of trained for that because I had learned how to have those kinds of conversations. I hadn't been to seminary yet, but I had learned to have those kinds of conversations through something called the Metropolitan Community Church, which is basically like the gay church, they used to call it, right? It's a worldwide denomination. But they had these things called biblical self-defense courses, because somebody would be like, they'd throw one Bible verse at you, and so you could come back at them with another one. And I thought, I'm just going to do this thing. And it was working, you know, all of a sudden we were just having a conversation. Neither of us were being antagonistic. And then the gentleman said to me, he mentioned that he had a lesbian sister. And for one reason or another, I just lost it. I got so angry at him because I was like, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You know, why is this what you think about your sister? Is this how you treat your sister? And what ended up happening is that he became upset. He became quiet. I could see in his face that he was experiencing something like shame. You know, he felt bad in some way, right? You could just sort of see that on people's faces. And I felt so victorious. And I just bid him adieu and I walked away. I'm telling you, within like 30 seconds, I was like, what did you just do?
Yeah.
Why did you do that? It was a terrible thing to do. You know exactly what that feels like. You know what it feels like when people do that, when they belittle you, when they dehumanize you, all these things. And so I turned around, I went back, I apologized, and I said, I need to learn more about this. I'm going to do better. And when I remembered back to that experience, I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do this PhD program. I'm going to go to seminary because I need to learn how to understand people like this better, how to communicate with them better. So that's what I did. I said, I'll put it on hold. I'll come back. I'll do my seminary. I'll come back. Lo and behold, I met my wife in seminary. I never went back for the PhD program, but it was really that single experience that happened while I was in college in Denver. And it all came together for me then. So I'd say that was, I mean, going to seminary, I mean, you know, you studied religion. I mean, religion is different from theology.
Yeah.
But it's like going into something like that, especially when you're coming from LGBT or any other kind of community, you don't know what you're going to encounter. You don't know what kind of vibe it's going to be, whether you're going to be accepted or not. It was a huge risk. Now, granted, there were a number of seminaries around the country that had a lot of LGBT students. We didn't say it then. We just said gay and lesbian, right? Students. And so I picked Pacific Coalition for that reason, because they had the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies and Religion. If I really wanted that real experience of learning about people like that guy that I encountered in front of the Capitol, I probably should have gone to a Bible college.
Yeah.
But I didn't know the difference. I had a lot of uncertainty around going to seminary. I was calling myself agnostic. I wasn't even a theist, a believer, you know, in that sense. So I was like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
But it turned out to be a wonderful decision I made and experience I had for many reasons.
That's incredible. Yeah, no, one of my undergraduate degrees is in religion, and it was from a public school. So exactly to your point, it was about the science of religion. It was more primarily was in Western religions, but I did some Eastern religions too. We had to do world stuff.
Yeah.
And so you read whatever the text is and accept it as fact, and then take a look at the implications anthropologically, from a literary standpoint, from a historical standpoint, to understand how religion is at the crux of cultural change and norms, right? So very fascinating degree, loved everything about it. So then similarly applied for seminary after school. And so I was between Fuller in Pasadena, because I grew up in Los Angeles as well, went to school in San Diego, and Princeton, because one of my mentors had gone to Princeton. And at that point, at least the Presbyterian, like USA, was on the cusp of like, it's okay if you're gay, we'll still ordain you and we're not going to banish you, you know? But I similarly had that moment, like I just graduated, things were kind of ready to go. And I was like, I don't know that this... If I'm just going to prove to myself that I can still be Christian and gay, that didn't seem like a good reason to go into that space. But again, it was always like, oh, I'll do it later. And then even when I was living in Iowa for a while, University of Iowa has a great religious studies program, thought about the PhD there. Again, it would be more in the science of it and the implications of religion. And so it constantly lingers in there as something that I probably will do at some point in time. But I was forced to have a hard conversation with myself at 22 to say, what are you really doing? Are you doing this because you're afraid? Like, I grew up in a very Christian environment. Parents not overly religious. Dad didn't really have faith. My mom was very Catholic growing up, but had some issues with the Catholic Church when I came out and was like, that doesn't seem right. Like, I don't think that's how that's supposed to work, right? But was very involved in church and youth group and all of those things, and then went to college, realized I was gay, and was like, oh, there could be some dissonance here. So it almost felt like I needed to keep going down the path that I was going down just to prove that, like, no, I can do both of these things, which is true. I believe to this day that I can do both of those things should I want to. But at 22 and in, 2004, that is a tough environment to have those conversations and to not know the communities that you could go to, which is why I love that you said you specifically looked at the Pacific University right in the heart of San Francisco, right, Berkeley area, as a place where at least there was some safety and a community that was going to help you navigate even the questions that you didn't know you were going to have, right?
Absolutely. You never know. ILIT is a pretty radical seminary.
It is. It is. It's true. DU's right down the road. Mm-hmm. It could be a possibility. We don't know.
I actually started at DU as an undergrad in the religious studies department. And once I figured out the difference between a quarter and a semester, I was like, oh, I'm out of here.
I'm out.
I'm going to Metro State. And I also had teachers that were younger than me. I was a 30-year-old freshman, and I had like 27 and 28-year-old grad students, doctoral students teaching me. And I was like, no, I need to go to Metro State where my professors have doctorates. And,
right. And you're not going to be the lone old guy in the class, right? That's the part that was—
In a room with, 400 students? We had, like 30-something students in a class? Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're still like 25 to 1, which is incredible to me for being a 18,000 person institution that we're still focusing on the teaching.
Yes.
Again, I've only worked in higher ed my entire career, so 25-ish years, all different size institutions. What I have found at MSU Denver and what has kept me here and will continue to keep me here until somebody says you can no longer work here, till I say something so crazy on the podcast and they're like, that's it, it's over, is the idea that it is so focused on the teaching and learning and has embraced— there are different ways to do that, community learning and all the things that we do from an engagement standpoint with our employers and the service learning and all that stuff. I will take that any day over the big time R1 institutions that I've worked at that may have tons more money and resources and all of those things. The experience is totally different. I remember being one of 300 people sitting in a lecture hall going like, nobody even cares if I'm here or not, versus when I took classes here, being like, no, I know my faculty member by name. I mean, even just before this, I ran to Starbucks to grab a coffee to kind of get myself ready for this. And all of a sudden, a gentleman walks up to me. He's like, hey, it's Brendan Jensen. And I looked, I was like, yep, you were my professor for speech ethics like 5 years ago. He's like, how are you, Jamie? And I was like, oh my gosh, you remember me from a class that I had with you literally probably 5 years ago. Wow. And that is an incredible thing. That'll never happen to me going back to UCSD or Indiana State or anywhere else that I went to school,
Yes. Yeah.
It's a very cool deal.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
So there's a million things we can talk about, but I obviously want to make sure that we get a good understanding of how important MSU Denver is to you and how that kind of informed a lot of the rest of your life that we've talked about. So first and foremost, I want to know what brought you to Denver and to Metro. We heard just a little bit that you started at DU and you were like, nah, I'm out of here. But what did you know about MSU Denver that you were like, this is going to be a better fit for me?
Well, what brought me to Denver the second time— I won't go into the first time, that's more of a personal story. But the second time I came to Denver was because I enrolled in what's called Veterans Upward Bound.
Yeah.
And they had a program, and the guarantee was if you completed the program, you were automatically going to be accepted to Metro State. So I did the fall semester in Veterans Upward Bound, which is a really wonderful program because we were in a classroom just with us. We weren't with other students, but we were in a regular classroom in a hall in one of the buildings. We had IDs just like everybody else, would let us use the bus. And eventually, they probably could use the light rail when that came in, and we could go to Tivoli and right. We could do all the things that a college student could, even though we weren't officially a college student. We were a Veterans Upward Bound. And so I completed that. And then I started in the spring semester of 1996. And so that's really what brought me there. Was there was no Veterans Upward Bound program where I was living in Tucson, Arizona at the time. So I was like, well, I really like Denver. I'll just go back there.
Yeah. I mean, you can't beat the mountains. I'll tell you that.
It's beautiful. It is. I had lived in Salt Lake City when I was a little bit younger. And so I was like, well, I like the Rockies from that side. Now I'll go live on the other side of the Rockies.
Yeah, let's go east and see what the sun setting over them looks like. I know. That's incredible. Yeah.
Of course, coming from California originally, I got a watch band with a little compass on it because I always thought I was going the wrong direction. For at least a year, I was like, wait a minute, where am I going? The mountains are
They're not north.
To the west.
They're not north
so
anymore.
Bizarre.
I know. I so grew up weird. In Pasadena area. So it's very similar with Torrance and knowing all that space. And it's funny when people are like, oh, well, that's always easy for you. The ocean's west. And I was like, it's not everywhere that you're in. Depending on where you're in, that little part of California that kicks out,
Yeah. It
isn't west. I could be going south and going to the ocean. And when I remember learning how to drive with my Thomas guide, you know, in the early 90s, looking around. But where I lived, the San Gabriel Mountains were north. Mm. And so that was my post. And what's crazy is if you stood at the mountains and looked exactly the opposite way, you'd see the ocean. That's south. And it was such a mind trick for people. Like when they'd come to visit, they're like, oh, that's west. I was like, it's not. That's south from where I'm situated in the valley. And that's just how you have to deal with it. Yeah. So here it is a little bit easier. I know exactly that the mountains are west and I'm good to go.
It's very clear. Demarcation.
It is. It is. So you got to campus that next spring semester after doing Upward Bound. And you did a lot of things while you were here.
Yeah.
In addition to studying in the communication space, you served on student government. You founded the Auraria Queer Alliance, or AQUA, and then worked in the GLBT Student Services Office. That's a lot of things to do while being on campus. And so what I hear from a lot of the people that we bring on this podcast is like, oh, no, get involved in all the things, do all the things. I walk around campus sometimes and I see students that are just here to learn because they believe that learning is only happening in the classroom, right? But what would you say from some of your experiences to say, no, getting involved was impactful to my entire overall education and even maybe what's happened since?
Yeah, I mean, I could not, right, get involved.
Yeah.
Well, most of us are social creatures. I definitely am. What I did was I just did the normal, right? Mm-hmm. I did 12 credits. Right. I didn't do anything more. And I went to summer school. Mm-hmm. And so that way I never felt like I was ever going to fall behind. And so my load wasn't very heavy. And I was a work study student. So I was a work study in GLBT Student Services where I was able to organize and coordinate and manage anything AQUA related. Right. We had the GLBT, I think they called themselves student organization, mm-hmm. something like that, but they were very social. And what AQUA did was much more political, like getting domestic partnership benefits for healthcare for students partners, right? That we lobbied for things like that. And so I was doing it while I was quote unquote at work. I was also running the Speakers Bureau and doing all the Safe Zone trainings and all the other events because I was there 20, 25 hours a week. And then, of course, on top of that, one year I did student government, right? My sophomore year, VP of communications. So that was a little bit on top, but not too much. But again, I was doing 12 credits. You know, I was a special education high school dropout, and I was also a student that accessed disability student services my first year at Metro State. And so a lot of people would automatically think what that means is, I don't know, I didn't have the same level of capability or capacity or intelligence, whatever that might be. And that can be true for some people, depending on what kinds of learning challenges they're dealing with. But for me, I had the advantages of having high intellect, but learning disabilities, right?
Sure.
And so the Disabled Student Services provided me with the accommodations that I needed. So I wasn't struggling.
Yeah.
I got the paperwork that I needed. They gave me those accommodations. And so I had time to do all of those things and more because I was also running the Lesbian Avengers chapter that I restarted in Denver while I was in school. And that was in the evening. And I did well grade-wise. I was in one of those honor societies. So I had a really easy and fun time in college. I never felt like I was doing too much. I've never experienced burnout in my life, not once. I think I'm really good with boundaries I did what I wanted to do, and I cut out all of the non-essentials.
Yeah, I think that's a testament to even just looking at how your career trajectory has gone. You said it earlier, you know, when you do something until you're done doing it, and then you're done. And so you're actually avoiding that need for burnout and hanging on to something because it either reminds you of something, or you think it's the thing you should be doing, or it's what people would expect from me. If we have just a little bit of agency to be like, no, I'm going to do the things I want, how I want to do them, as long as I'm not harming anybody else along the way, go and do those things. And that's how you get to your full life, right? It's a pretty easy message, but I think it gets so lost in worrying about what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, like, startup culture is perfect for me. Get in, set things up, set them in motion, teach, train, resource. As soon as people have it, move on.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I'm perfect for that kind of environment. If I had to stay year after year after year and doing the same thing over and over again, no, I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons I love being a social worker is because of the social work.
Yeah.
And that's why I picked it. I can work in so many different environments, doing so many different types of social work with so many different types of people, right? Different populations, we would say, who are dealing with so many different issues.
Yeah.
Right. It's from medical issues to addiction issues to mental health to all kinds of things, grief.
Yeah.
And so I love that. It keeps me engaged.
Yeah. That keeps the curiosity going, because yeah. I do think there's a reality to this idea that when you're stuck in a rut and you're concerned about all the things that are happening around you in that space, you're less inclined to get out of that rut. And so then you just become prey to it, mm-hmm. right? And that's when you find yourself in a space that you're not getting your curiosity, your natural need for curiosity fed. If you're a people person, you're not getting your people and your community and your extrovert stuff fed. And so I think it's a great model. I always say that I am a great fixer. I don't want to start it. I don't want to sustain it. If it's messed up and messy and gross and no one can make sense of it, then I'm your lady. Bring me in. I'll fix your shit. I'll get it where it needs to be. But then if I have to be responsible to stick around and make sure that it really works and continues to grow, I'm out.
Yeah. I resonate with that. I refer to it as troubleshooting. I'm a troubleshooter.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm in my mid-40s now, starting to have like my mid-midlife crisis, or it's probably just a midlife crisis at this point. I hope I don't live too much beyond 90. But it's one of those things where you start to just say, okay, this is the longest I've ever worked anywhere. This is the longest I've ever lived anywhere. But I'm actually happy. Like, I'm super content, and more than just content. Like, I'm actually enjoying and thriving in a lot of personal spaces and all these things. But there's something in the back of my brain, because yeah. I am so wired to just be kind of a fixer and a mover and a troubleshooter, that I'm like, how do I operate and continue to stay me with the positive things and the assets that I bring to something in a totally new space where, like, I'm just kind of happy and I'm now at a place that I am kind of sustaining the jobs that we're doing. I mean, we're still growing and we're still building, but we're also doing it well. And so it's just an uncomfortable space. And I'm finding myself now having to have different conversations with myself.
Yeah, absolutely. My father used to differentiate between vocation and avocation. Right. When he would have conversations with me, he'd say, like, some people find a job that fulfills them. And some people get a job that pays the bills, and then they do the thing that fulfills them outside of their job. Mm-hmm. One isn't better than the other. It just depends on the person. Right. Some of the greatest philosophers and artists have been tradespeople. Right. They're working with their hands all day long. So their mind is free to come up with ideas and to run scenarios. Some people, they find their passion and they link it with their job. They're an avid bicyclist and they get a job working at a bike shop and they love it.
Yeah.
You know, and they love the culture and they go to all the races and they just love all the trade shows. Like, it's their whole world. But some people, they do keep those things separate. And I've been more of a keep them separate person. But currently, I feel like I'm more in the, my passion and my job are one now.
Yeah.
But it took a long time for me to, I wouldn't say get here, because again, it's not a goal, but to find it.
Yeah.
To find it.
I think the other key component for me too is the people in the community that you're surrounded with, both in and outside of work, right? I don't think there's any way that if it was vocational for you, right? This is the job that's paying the bills so I can do the things that I want to do. If you had to do that in an environment where you were not at least enjoying the time that you were there with the people in that space, that's also going to make that a lot harder. And so mm-hmm. I think all of that's true. The passion and connecting that with what are your intended outcomes for that? But not selling short the interactions that you have with the humans around you, because so much of that informs just our ability to be who we are in the environments that we are.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just because school is out for the summer doesn't mean our doors are closed. Join the MSU Denver Alumni Association for a handful of fun and engaging activities in June. Whether you want to join us on June 11th for the Alumni Art Exhibit at the CVA, catch a baseball game at the MSU Denver Night with the Rockies on June 20th, or tee off with us at the Roadrunners Athletics Golf Tournament on June 24th, there's plenty of ways to stay connected with us this summer. Visit msudenver.edu/alumni/events to learn more and register. This episode is brought to you by The Birdie. Make that an eagle.
But you said other than your marriage to your wife, who you've been with for 23 years?
23 years.
My goodness, congratulations. Thank you. MSU Denver is another one of the most important places, times in your life. I'd love to hear a little bit more about why. And then also, knowing that that is something that you say and that it lives in your brain as an important place, how do you find yourself calling upon that? Or do you find yourself nostalgic about it? Or is it something happens and it makes you think of Metro? Or what does that look like?
Well, I mentioned it just a moment ago that I was a special education high school dropout. I got my GED and I was raised by my father as a single parent, but my mother was always around because I was in LA. She was in San Diego. So I saw her from time to time. Neither of them finished high school. Mm-hmm. Right. So there was no real encouragement to go to college in my family. I'm first generation Mexican American. It was just sort of like, go to work, right? Do your job and make a living and, you know, live a happy life. The idea of college was so far away from my reality that when I initially decided, you know what, I think I'm going to go to college. I mean, let's be honest. At the time, I was just sick of working.
Fair. Totally and, fair.
Because I had started working when I was, you know, a teenager, and I'd been through the military and doing that undercover stuff. And then I went off and did a bunch of other things. And I'm just kind of sick of working. And maybe this is something you can relate to, maybe not. But as a trans guy, you know, this is before our transition. So what I was starting to notice is that every time I was in a workplace where I was doing well and I wanted to get promoted or they were promoting me, I was eventually going to end up in some sort of position where there was going to be more emphasis on my attire, right? I was no longer going to be in a uniformed position or a dressed down kind of attire. It was going to be more professional attire. And of course, that would have been professional women's attire, which, I mean, it's god awful. At least it was in the 80s and 90s.
It
might still be. And so for me, it was so off. It was so wrong. I never wore a dress or anything. I would have looked like a drag queen doing that. But I was wearing, you know, pants suits or some ridiculous thing like that. And I was like, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't do this thing. I can't be this professional woman. I got to figure something else out. And I'm like, maybe I'll go to college. I just got to get away from this place. It's probably unusual, but I only applied to one college, and that was DU. I got in, but I didn't like it. And then I transferred over to Metro State. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, there's all these things I can do. I can work here. I can go to school here. I can make friends here. I can do activities and events. It's a whole experience.
Yeah.
Right? It's a very holistic experience, especially for a commuter campus.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that makes sense to people maybe if you're in a residential life experience, but it was so full. You didn't even miss that there was no dorms there. At least I didn't. And so, okay, I'm going to give it a go. Let's see how this works. So all of that support that I had in, all of the activities and events that I was engaged in, that was that first year. The second year, all of a sudden, I'm encouraged and then elected into student government. I'm working, you know, in GLBT student services. I'm doing more work there, I should say. I got an award from a chamber of commerce, like the LGBT Chamber of Commerce in Denver.
Yeah.
You know, that year I got an award, something like Students to Watch award. And right. So like things are starting to happen. And I think it was the first time in my life where exactly who I was, doing exactly what I wanted to do, was being not only just allowed, mm-hmm. it was encouraged, it was welcomed, and it was rewarded.
Yeah.
Right? I was literally getting awards. That is not anything I can ever forget, because it's really the only time in my life when that happened, even to this day, which is probably why I am very nostalgic about it. And then, like, what, a decade or more after I graduate, I get this alumni award. I'm like, who nominated me for that? In 2016, your distinguished alumni, I was like, this is the gift that never stops giving. Mm-hmm. I can tell you a clear difference is that I'm not going to mention the school because that's not very nice. But another school that I went to, a graduate school, and another award that I've gotten in the course of my career, they didn't even send an email to the department saying congratulations to our graduate who got this big award. Mm. Like, that to me is a big difference.
Yeah,
I've never heard from the seminary or the other graduate school I went to since I graduated. So it just sticks out, and it continues to stick out, because then one day I got an invitation to come on this podcast.
Yeah.
Right. So it's an ongoing story. And I tell people about it all the time. You know, my wife knows almost everything about Metro State and what I did there and what it means to me, because it's important.
Yeah.
And I talk about it all the time.
Ah, this brings me so much joy, Xander. I appreciate it. I was actually in 2016, when you got that award, I remember, I think we briefly met. I had just started working for the alumni. Mm-hmm. When I started here in late 2013, I was doing more fundraising. And I remember coming over that way. Was Janelle and Megan still around?
Yes.
Yeah. So, because mm-hmm. I think they were like, hey, Jamie, you should come to this and meet some of our alums. I was like, awesome. And that was the year, I think it was our 50th anniversary. So we were celebrating outstanding alum from each decade. And so you were our 1990s yeah. rep. And I remember I met Jonathan Stalls, who has also been on this podcast with me as well at that same event, because I think he got the 2000s award. And so it is such a fascinating thing. I love to hear that it means something to you guys, because obviously, like, this is our job. So we are thoughtful in making sure that we make people feel connected. But so much of it is just natural and grassroots. Absolutely. It's like, no, you did something cool. We want to say congratulations. And then as we learn more, we're like, no, we want to hear more about this entire book of incredible mm-hmm. things that you've done. And so I love to hear that it's working, and that people are feeling as though their decision to come to MSU Denver is still paying dividends even after they leave, that it's still not just a nostalgic, great feeling that you had that makes you think of a time back then, but also can say, no, it's really important, because it continues to be a part of my day, maybe not my day to day, but my year to year, you know, and that you talk mm-hmm. about it. And that's wonderful.
Well, and I'm still in touch with individuals that were really pivotal in my life when I was at Metro State. So, for example, my academic advisor, Dr. Diane Blomberg, who I'm still in touch with, who encouraged me to go to graduate school. Yeah. And I believe my first response was, what's that? I didn't even know what graduate school was.
Right.
And she was the one that encouraged me to change over to interpersonal communication, because I remember I delivered my very first speech in her speech 101 class. And she came up to me afterwards and she said, how long did you practice that speech for? And I looked at her and I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you wrote your outline. I'm like, uh-huh. And then how many times did you like say it out loud before you did it in class? And I said, oh no, I just ran it through my head on the bus on the way to school this morning. And she's like, yeah, that's what I thought. Like, you're a natural.
Yeah.
You should think about going into interpersonal communication. Mm-hmm. And then had a lot of really good experiences during my time there and since with Tara Tall, who was involved in the Women's Institute,
yeah.
Who nominated me for that Student to Watch For award. Mm-hmm. And then Karen Benson, who was the director of GLB2 Student Services. She was a social worker who went over to DU to teach at the School of Social Work. And there's even more, like Yolanda Ortega, mm-hmm. like people that were involved in my everyday life that I stayed in touch with for many years. And three of them, you know, Tara, Karen, and Diane, to this day, I'm still in touch with.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. And I don't want to speak ill of other larger institutions, but I don't know that that is as true the bigger the school that you're at and the less personal those relationships are. I mean, I've talked about it on this podcast. I've talked about it in real life multiple times, that one of the things I love so much about here, I experienced it as a student here. pretty much everyone that's been on the podcast has experienced it as a student here, is that it's constantly specific people that maybe lifted us from our bootstraps to help us whatever we needed to do. It was someone saying, oh, no, you should do this. You should actually think about interpersonal communication because it turns out you have a knack for this. Or, hey, maybe you should get into this space. Or have you thought about this? Because I'm seeing that you have this skill set and these activities and creates a unique experience for you in this lane. And I never got that in my first undergraduate experience. That's not entirely true. I had one faculty member. It was an anthropology class that somehow we were talking about Old Testament and some sort of anthropological piece of it. And it turns out that she also then would take students on a dig and actually take you to Israel for the summers. And you get to see things. You're not actually archaeologists, so you're not doing the dig, but you're seeing the artifacts and the things that are happening to try and make sense of the cultures. And she came up to me after the end of that quarter. It was quarters. So I feel you on that. And was like, I want you to do this with me this summer. And it was the only time that I think a professor knew my name and understood that the paper I wrote was actually me in class, you know? Yeah. And I'm bummed that I didn't take her up on it, but I was also an athlete in college. And so I was like, oh, I can't miss summer. I won't play next year, you know, or I'll have a lot of things I got to worry about. So one out of how many courses have I taken over my lifetime that I had that connection where I feel like that is something that is pretty consistent here, that students will have it if they are open to it, because professors know that that's a big part of how we can create some really lasting impact and change for our students.
Absolutely. Makes a big difference.
Happy Pride Month, Roadrunners. Did you know that MSU Denver has an LGBTQ plus alumni network? This group is committed to providing opportunities for connection and networking with fellow alumni and current students in the LGBTQ plus community. Visit msudenver.edu/alumni/participate to learn more about our affinity groups and to join.
We sell our pride socks. We do all sorts of things. We do the pride parade. Mm-hmm. Like, it is a big part of this campus and this community. And so we wanted to make sure that we were really thoughtful about this. And so I'd love, if you're willing to chat a little bit about like what's going on right now with LGBTQ rights and what are some things that we can do either as people in that community or allies to that community to understand what's really going on and what the agendas are kind of there, and what we can do to help and support and be thoughtful in that space.
You know, people often do ask me, hey, Xander, you know, are you afraid because of this? Are you angry because of that? Right? Some social media thing that somebody posted and an executive order or something like that. And my response to is, are you angry or are you scared? Is always no, because I have control over how I feel, and I'm not going to let things like that, you know, I'm not going to spend my energy on those kinds of things. Yeah. I'm not on social media except for LinkedIn, so I don't see any of that nonsense. And I highly recommend people get off of social media. I look forward to when that cycles out of being interesting for people, because I think it's such a waste of time, unless it's, you know, business or, you know, promotion, outreach, sure, but not that other stuff. And so that's one thing I say to people is like, for your own well-being, turn off notifications, mute people, get rid of apps on your phones, like take care of yourself so that you're not bombarded by all of the messaging around what people think is happening.
Yeah.
Right. And then go and read first source documents. When people are like, did you hear about that executive order? I'm like, hold on, I'll be right back. I'll go to the White House website and I read the executive order.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, so there's this, 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 and this. Now what we have to do is wait and see. So right now we're in the wait and see phase. So I'm not going to get all worked up about what may or may not happen because nothing's really happened. Things are being challenged in the courts. And so that's my take on it. My take is I'm going to wait and see how it all settles out after all of the lawsuits work their way through the various levels of the judicial system and see what happens.
Yeah.
On a personal level, as a veteran, there was a short period of time where I thought maybe I was going to lose access to not my healthcare in total, of course not, but my healthcare that's specifically related to being trans, like my hormones. I've been getting them from the VA for 20 years now. So my first thought was, okay, I might lose these benefits. Mm-hmm. What are the alternatives? So then I just looked around to see, You know, there's like 6, 7, 8 clinics here in Orlando that I could go to. There's like 3 or 4 or 5 telehealth companies I could use. So I was like, okay, so there's my backup plan. I got all of those options, right? And so even people in rural areas have the telehealth option if they don't have the same kind of options like I have here in a more urban area with all these clinics. So that's what I had to do for myself was I need a plan B until it all shakes out. And this shook out a little bit more quickly. The policy or the directive was rescinded, granting us all kinds of benefits. But when they put out the new one, it said, if you're already being treated by the VA, like, for example, you're getting hormones, you're going to still get them. And I was like, okay, I'm good. I'm good to go. But now I know what to tell other veterans who maybe haven't been treated yet, or people who, there's people out there that are saying things that are just not true. Like, you've lost your benefits at the VA. It's like, no, you haven't. They've gotten rid of the LGBTQ veteran care coordinators. No, they haven't.
Yeah.
Individual systems may have, people might have left their jobs. I know that is happening, but as a total, those patient advocates that are specific to the LGBTQ veteran population that are seeking benefit services through Veterans Health Administration, they are allowed to remain because they're considered to have a particular competency for a veteran population.
Yeah.
A lot of what I do is let people know that things are still in flux. Some things have been worked out, maybe temporarily, but at least I think that can help put people at ease.
I think it's the not knowing and the worst case scenario, catastrophic thinking that inflates this so much, right?
Well,
and so
yeah.
I think there's such a valuable space. I mean, I think we could say this about anything, but yes. Such a valuable space for just knowledge. And I do appreciate, I chuckled a little bit when you were like, yeah, I just go to the actual source document and get the information. That is a foreign concept, I think, for a lot of people. And I'm the first person, I have opinions on things. I like to think that I could be persuaded because I don't come in with concrete biases that I'm like, you are not going to move me on this. Like, there are very few things in my life that I'm just like, nope, this is 100% truth and you can't tell me otherwise. So I think I annoy the hell out of some people. I know I annoyed the crap out of my dad because my dad would try to be like, so, well, do you hear about this? What do you think about this? And my response would always be like, I don't know. I haven't read that. I haven't gone into it. If you want to have this discussion, give me like a day and let me do some research and I'll come back to you. And he's like, oh, you're just chicken. You don't want to argue. And it's like, no, sir. It's not that I don't want to argue. It's that what am I going to argue if I'm just saying, well, I think it's this or it's like this. None of these things can operate in just a I think and I like, you know?
That is what a lot of people are doing. And so the catastrophizing, as you mentioned, I mean, that's just as a clinician, that's something that I know how to deal with. It's a cognitive distortion. There are cognitive behavioral therapy techniques that I can teach people to, you know, step away from catastrophizing. And I can teach people how to regulate their emotions and how to tolerate distress. And hopefully they'll apply those techniques and strategies and tools in order to keep their stress levels down, because if they don't keep their stress levels down, then they're going to disrupt their sleep and they're going to disrupt their appetite and they're going to disrupt their immune system and they're going to disrupt their circulatory system. Because when we're stressed, we're tense. And when we're tense, our muscles are tight. When our muscles are tight, they constrict blood flow. And it's like, it's as simple as that.
Yep.
For me, I know it's simple because I'm a medical social worker and I talk people through these things all the time. But for the everyday person, they're like, wait, that relates to that? How and what? And what? Like, why shouldn't I be outraged? You know, TikTok University is telling me to be outraged. Yeah, but also I'm not baited. I don't get baited. People, they put the bait on the hook. They toss it out at me and I say, let's come back around to this in a couple of days. I need to do my research.
I'm the same way.
And they're like, you just should be angry because we're supposed to be angry. And I'm like, I don't have time to be angry.
Yeah.
I got other things to do.
Yeah.
But then that gets me in trouble, right? And so in my book, in the Third Space, The Nonconformist Guide to the Universe, I talk about the consequences that occur in your in-group, right? In your peer group, in your social group, when you're the person that says, you know, I have a different thought about that, or I've had a different experience, or, you know, I think there's more to it than that. Mm-hmm. It can go very bad, very quickly. We're much more hostile to our in-group members who violate the orthodoxy than the out-group members who we just assume are evildoers.
Right.
Right. We don't expect anything from them because they're just bad people doing bad things. But our group, it's like, how dare you? How dare you have a different opinion? And it's like, oh, you know what else I have a different opinion on? Here you go.
Yeah.
And so, but I've always been that way. Mm-hmm. That nonconformist in me is, I don't do it intentionally to just be a thorn in someone's side. I really do have the ability to bridge build and see more than two sides of an issue. And I can hold things that might be inconsistent. You know, who was it? Like, I think it's Ralph Waldo Emerson said that consistency is the, what did he call it? The, oh, for God's sake, I can't remember that exact quotation. Something like the gobbledygook of the small-minded, or, you know, like we're not consistent.
Right.
I learned about that actually when I was at Metro State. When I was there, there was a lesbian who was working in the student publications office. She was part of Log Cabin Republicans.
Sure.
And I remember being,
yeah,
it was like an affront. I was like,
yeah.
Wait, what? You're a lesbian and you're, she referred to herself as a d-. I don't know if you'll cut that out, but that's her language for herself. And you're a Republican. I was like, I was Green Party, so I couldn't even be Democrat. I was green, you know, I went all the way. And she just sort of talked to me about stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. And there's this whole organization. And then when I went off to seminary, I met a woman there whose cousin, I think, made Log Cabin Republicans go national, right? This gay and lesbian Republican organization. And they're all over the country. They still are. But it was when I learned about it, that was kind of a pivotal moment for me. I knew about these things, but it was a very visceral thing because it wasn't just something outside of me. It wasn't some topic I was discussing. It was much closer to home.
Yeah.
Right? Like, wait, aren't they the enemy? You know, she's like, no. And I'm like, what? I've been told they're the enemy.
But that's, you know, what my in people told me. I'm with you. And I've actually noticed it, especially even in my circles, from people that I consider intelligent and empathetic and thoughtful. But there have been some really firm lines drawn in the sand that then even when one person in that space has crossed over that line, it's a much quicker reaction to be like, if I think you're wrong there, then you must just be wrong. And it is unique. That didn't happen in my formidable years, right? It's really just been in these last few years where I do think there is so much of this, we have to hold our ground because we have catastrophic thoughts and we're fearing what is possible instead of what is right in front of us.
Yeah.
But I too find myself, I even joke that a lot of the people on my staff get mad at me sometimes because they tell me I'm too diplomatic.
Yes.
Which is their nice way of being like, I need you to go to war for me. And you're sitting there and you're empathizing with their situation. And I was like, it's just inherent to who I am. I trace my moment back, like you do to the Log Cabin Republicans. I trace mine back to being a religion major, going to school with all intentions of being a pastor and realizing at 19 that I was gay. I, at that moment, had to have a very serious reconciliation of this idea that two things that I thought were very different and could not stand together, I had to spend the next 5 years finding a way to realize that they can cohabitate in a singular person and that won't break the world, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm so glad that I had that experience. Looking back now, at 20, I did not want to have that experience at 19, 20 years old. But now in my 40s, I can look back and say that was so formative for me because it has allowed me to be a person that can find myself in any situation mm-hmm. and be like, yeah, no, I hear exactly what you're saying, and being very thoughtful about how understanding the logic that brought you to your conclusion and not calling your logic wrong. That's not wrong. It's just a way to approach this. Mm-hmm. If you take out the very first given in your proof and put something else in, you might realize your logic doesn't work. I might realize my logic doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I have these conversations, especially with our family that's in Iowa all the time, that people be like, I can't believe you can have that conversation with very stereotypical Iowans. And I was like, but no, they're not wrong. I understand why they're saying these things. I'm just providing another alternative. If you have this other set of information, data that you have either not seen because you're choosing not to, or you just didn't know, mm-hmm. right? It might inform the decision-making different. But I do laugh that constantly I'm told, well, you're too diplomatic in those meetings. You need to just come in and say, and I was like, no, I'm not that person. I'm never going to come in and say, this is it. And this is how we're going to do it. And that's it. Yeah. Because that presumes that I am right. And I'm at least smart enough to know that I shouldn't be right that often, right?
Well, and it's so, I don't even know what the word is. I mean, it's the thinking that somebody knows what's best for other people.
The word that comes to mind for me is pompous. Mm. I don't know if that encapsulates everything you're saying, but there's an arrogance.
It's elitist.
It is elitist, yeah. Right? And it's very privileged to also believe that your experiences in which maybe mean that if that exact same thing was happening to you, you could and would respond this way, completely denies the fact that you're bringing with you your privilege, your experience, your knowledge, things that other people may or may not have or might look different. Mm-hmm. And so it is fascinating to me, the whole idea that anybody should tell anyone else exactly what they should do in a certain situation because they don't have all of the data coming in, right?
Yeah, I mean, granted, let's say every trans person in the United States is having their own experience with what they're hearing, what they're seeing, what is happening to them on the ground. So I can't just also say like, well, you should be having experience like me.
Right.
All I can do is help people to sort of navigate some of those parallel things that are going along with it, which is their stress and the conflict and the feeling overwhelmed.
Sure.
You know, I can help them manage those things because they're going to have to sort it out for themselves. But the thing that I noticed that's happened over the years is going into the lesbian community was a refuge from the larger society, mm-hmm. right? It's a place where I could go and just be me. And even though there's all the subcultures and subcommunities within, when we all came together for a dance or an event, we were just there, right? It was the sisterhood. Mm-hmm. But now I find that that refuge is more likely for me to be outside of the trans community than in it. Because there's a sense of, like you said, in the last few years, there is a sense of if you don't subscribe to this orthodoxy, then you are a bad person.
Yeah.
You're associating with the wrong people. You have the wrong ideas because it doesn't fit with whatever they think or what they've been told. And so now I find that I go into other kinds of spaces, which would be considered like just like general society spaces. And it's there that I can be more who I am fully.
Yeah.
In the earlier days of my transition, I experienced a sense of loss and grief of losing that camaraderie and that, you know, not to use a term that I don't use very often, but safe space, right? To now be like, oh, I've been kicked out into big old society, the supposedly heteronormative world. What am I supposed to do out here? I don't know how to navigate these treacherous seas, but I've been learning how to surf these waves and I've gotten better and better at it and find that I'm like, yeah, I like it out here.
Turns out.
I don't need to go into the safe space. I can stay out here because I can deal with it. I mm-hmm. have the skills to be able to do it. And I can be in conversation with people that I disagree with and they disagree with me, or we have different ideas and I don't feel personally offended and I don't get angry at them. We can still break bread. I have no issue with that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, because people say to me the things that you might assume they'd say, like, well, you know, you're not really a man. And I'll say, well, I mean, technically I'm female, but I live in the world as a man. Nobody sees me or hears me and says, I'm not really sure about that guy, right? They might think I'm gay because I gesture a lot. And maybe the way I talk might be, you know, I still have some of the feminine cues, so to speak.
Sure.
Right. So, and what I usually say to people when they say things to me like that is, well, I know I took a biology class.
Right.
I know that. You know, versus people in the trans community that I know personally would get very angry at that because they don't hold on to a sense that sex is biological and therefore fixed.
Yeah.
Right. To them, it's something that's as fluid as gender expression is. And I don't hold that. I think sex is fixed and gender is fluid. So that also means that I don't go crazy when people say things to me like that. So for me, it's a good protective factor to just be like, sure, yeah. But it's when people used to say to me back in the day, I'm going to pray for you because you're a sinner. I just say, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thank you. Right? What am I going to do?
Yeah.
How dare you? How dare you pray for me? How dare you have religious views that believe that I'm a sinner? Because I'd be like, right. Wait a minute, aren't we all? Isn't that really what?
Isn't that the whole story?
What system are you from?
Exactly. Exactly. That's the premise of all of this, is that we all sinned and fell short of the glory, right? Yeah.
Like, I was raised Catholic. I mean, yeah. It's a global thing here. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's the truth. To your point, it's a way that I think is natural for you to respond to that because you can and have been in multiple environments where you're navigating different kind of understandings and ideologies, right? But it is also, as you said, it's protective in a way because it lets you not recreate that exact moment that happened at Pride outside of Queen Supers, right? When you let somebody make you mad and then you turned around and just exhibited the same exact behavior. We're all guilty of doing that at some point. I love that you had the moment to be like, no, I just did what that person was trying to do to me, and that's not okay. And so if we can bridge those lines in the sand that we draw by just remembering that there's still humanity at the core of all of this, and just be a little bit nicer, be a little bit more empathetic, or in some cases be empathetic at all, right? It just would make for a bunch.
It doesn't have to be contingent on something, right?
No, right? Yeah, it just, I don't know. It sounds like it's pretty easy, and I feel like we've got it figured out here, Xander. So if we could just
that's right. Well, I mean, that's why I've been involved in what's called the Pro-Human Foundation for the last couple of years with Daryl Davis, who is a phenomenal man. If people are unfamiliar with him, just do an internet search for Daryl Davis and TED Talk. Daryl Davis is a Black man who has helped over 200 members of the KKK and neo-Nazi groups walk away from those organizations and from that hatred.
Yeah.
Because he was willing to sit down and have a conversation with them where he listened to them and he treated them like a human being. He didn't like their ideas, but he loved them as a human.
Right.
So to me, that's the way, right? That's the message.
It is.
That works for me. He wrote the foreword for my book, so I'm indebted to him for just being in my life and supporting my work. But that whole pro-human thing, it's saying, I don't really care. You may have done bad things, but you're not a bad person. Now, granted, of course, there are the few people in our society that are true sociopaths. It's very rare, and I don't know that I've ever really encountered one, so I'm not negating that. But I think too often we hear people say, you know, like, oh, that person's a narcissist, or that person's gaslighting, or that person this, or that person that. When you get right down to it, it's like, I just think you don't like them. And maybe your relationship has some dysfunction in it, but is it possible that you're at all contributing to the dysfunction? You know, you can do that in a therapy session. You don't really do that with your friends or family because that's a kind of a no-go zone. But it's, you know, it's in the back of my mind. I'm going, yeah, I'm sort of reading between the lines here.
Yeah. It takes a level of emotional maturity, though, and self-assurance to be able to step back and say, how am I contributing to the feelings that I'm having about some situation, right? I'm a big believer in the idea that if you start to see a pattern in all the way that people treat you or the things that are happening around you, man, you got to take a step back and figure out what the common denominator is, right?
Yeah. I mean, what's the consistent thing here? I think it's me.
Exactly, right? And if we don't have enough emotional intelligence or we're afraid of the answer, which I think a lot of people know that they probably need to ask that question, but if you're afraid of the answer because then that totally blows up your worldview or even what you've built your ego on, those are hard things to do. When you make a realization in your life that's like, oh, this is going to change everything I know or believe to know about myself. Those are hard things to do. Again, some of us went through it with certain things. I was fortunate to go through it in a safe community, in a good environment with people that I trusted and that cared for me when I was 19, and with a lot of privilege, right? With parents and with family and with a place to live and not worrying about all those things. Yeah. That's a harder thing when maybe some of those pillars are not there or it's a different point in life. I think about even your story, determining and understanding that you had felt trans for a long time and then not making that decision to actually transition till 39. Like, that's a late in life decision that you've now already lived a whole life a certain way. And now, to your point, the communities, the different things, that's a big shakeup. If you're not equipped to be able to answer and ask some pretty tough questions of yourself, that could be really challenging. And it could be devastating for people if they don't have the systems around them to support them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's Ram Dass who, the quotation from him, that's like, wherever you go, there you are.
Correct. That's exactly it.
Right?
It's true.
You know, other people, oh, the grass is always greener. It's like, mm-mm, you know. Mm-mm. When I think back, you know, because now it's been 20 years, right? 20 years on hormones, on testosterone. And so a lot has happened in the last 20 years. And I feel like I lived a full life, you know, up to 39. I mean, that's basically 40 years on the planet because we started zero, which doesn't make sense to me. I think we should get credit for the time in the womb.
For the first year. I'm with you.
Which for me would have been, what, 7 months? I was 2 months preemie. So I thought, you know, well, let's try the next 40 years doing something else.
Something different.
It was kind of a casual thing for me. I didn't have the typical trans backstory. I knew since I was four, I was born in the wrong body. Mm-hmm. I was going to kill myself. None of that is true for me. None of it. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, most trans people I meet, it's not true for them either. I think a lot of people just gotten used to telling a story that's expected of them from the professionals. I don't know if you want to cut that cassette. You know, that's a little insider trading. But, you know, it has been quite an experience. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was part of the lesbian community that was very separatist. You know, men were kind of second class and anything they had to do or say was sort of taken with a grain of salt, and women were better at everything and always will be. And, you know, it wasn't very nice. Let's just put it that way. And going along with that, there was a sense of, I feel like I got the message and I internalized the message that I knew everything I needed to know about who men were, what made a man, what motivated them. Yeah, it was not good things. Let's just put it that way. So the idea of one stepping outside of lesbian community to transition was a big risk.
Yeah.
We basically lose our community, a lot of us. And then we're going on this adventure that a lot of us are so arrogant. I was this way. I thought I knew exactly, like, oh yeah, people call me sir all the time already. So they're already kind of treating me like a guy. Oh no. No, I didn't realize, one, how much lonelier it is as a man in our society, and how more narrow the allowances are for emotion expression and friendship kind of bonding. That unless you've been friends for a long, long time, there's just these narrow limitations, and just walking around and all of a sudden having this experience of, oh, I can't just do the head nod and the little half smile at every woman I think is a lesbian now. You know, I can't do the, hey, what's up? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's like, I can't do that anymore.
Because
they're like, what are you looking at me like that for, you perv? I'm more alert, a little more on guard, I think. But I thought I knew all I needed to know. All of a sudden, I was going to have all this stuff. The world was going to be my oyster. And I was like, yeah, it hasn't worked out that way. And the reality is a bit more in between the things that we think oftentimes, or even outside of the stereotypes. And so that was a really good experience, especially because as a social worker, I ended up working with veterans who are majority male, right? Who goes in the military, majority men still. And it depends on the branch too. And then I went to work in the military, same thing. And so all of a sudden I was like, oh, I'm working with men who are dealing with all kinds of emotional and mental and other kinds of challenges. And I realized, wait a minute, my social work program only taught me to work with women and children. They didn't really teach me how to work with men. As I'm learning how to basically walk the world as somebody who people assume is male, right? Like socially as a man, legally, I guess, all of that was coming towards me. And now I'm working with men who are automatically going to assume that I understand all these different things that I'm not understanding. They're having experiences that I can relate to, but from a different perspective, and their symptomology is different.
Yeah.
Right? Like depression shows up differently for men than for women. Eating disorders are different. And so men typically don't get diagnosed properly and don't go to therapy or the doctor as often. Well, maybe that's because they're not being diagnosed properly, but you know, it's probably a chicken and the egg kind of thing. We don't really know, but that helped me because as I was learning myself personally, sort of walking this new existence, right, as a trans man and then working with men, I was putting it all together.
Yeah.
So it was a really wonderful experience, actually. And what it did was it gave me so much empathy for what men are going through.
Right.
And the things that we don't talk about in the same way.
Yeah.
Like childhood sexual abuse of boys and interpersonal violence towards men from women and men in relationships. We don't talk about those things. Where do men go who are dealing with domestic violence? Where's the shelter for them?
Yeah.
Where do they go? So that it really helped me to understand that more fully. It's not why I transitioned, obviously, but it's definitely one of the gifts that I've gotten as a result of being able to transition. It's something I would have never understood the way I understand it now had I not transitioned.
Yeah, I think it is. It's beautiful. You're uniquely situated to have both of those perspectives. And it just makes me so cognizant and aware that we have to fight through the noise of whatever biases or whatever social media, the internet, our worst case scenarios. We have to fight through all of that to understand that there might be nuggets of nuance and truth in some of that, but it has been extrapolated to create something that it cannot be applied to everybody in every situation to know all the things. And so if there's anything that I'm taking away from our conversation, even just this last part today, is like, you don't know, Jamie. So don't presume that you know, and don't make decisions based on the fact that you think you know.
Yeah.
Be open, see humans in a way to be able to understand that there is a common ground that you have. Might not be your beliefs, it might not be your values, it might not be those tenets that we have right away, but we're both humans. And then trust that you can have enough empathy to hear the words that someone is saying and realize that they're not doing it purposefully to be an asshole, right? They're doing it because it is validating something that they do hold and information they have that maybe you don't know or haven't experienced.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and a few years ago, right, we switched from intention is what mattered to impact is what mm-hmm. matters. So we disregarded the intentions mm-hmm. and only went with the impact. And it's like, oh no, because people can overreact.
Correct.
People conjure up things that didn't even happen.
Correct.
You just never know.
Yep.
Unless a person is blatantly, and even so, right, if somebody came right up in my face and started hurling all kinds of obscenities and derogatory, prejudicial terms and phrases and statements at me, I still have
autonomy to decide.
Agency to,
yep.
to decide how I'm going to respond. I don't have to be reactionary.
Yeah.
I still have that.
No, I'm 100% with you. There has to be a burden and an onus because it goes back to the very first thing anybody ever learns about communication. It is a two-way phenomenon. And so just because I say words, they have to be received. So you can't take intention out of that. You can't solely just look at the impact and say, well, you said this word and this is what it did. You have to ask the question of why did it do that? Because it was received in a way that created something else.
Yeah.
I just appreciate that there's good conversations happening about all these things that live in my brain rent-free of like how not to be a jerk, you know?
Well, remember, you know, in childhood, I remember I used to hear it. It was the little jingle, sticks and stones may break my bones, but
words will never hurt me. Yeah.
That's right. Or hurt me. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I guess I took that to heart. You know,
yeah. It's words yeah. only have the power that you let them have.
That's right.
Right. You give them power in that space. So
absolutely.
Xander, this has been incredible. I want to be cognizant of time. I know that you probably have very important things to do, but this has been really meaningful and special for me. And I know it will be for our viewers too, because there's just so many ways that any of the conversations that we've talked about and all of the incredible stuff that you've done through the course of your first act, right?
Yeah.
Can be really seen as just, again, getting at this heart of like, we can all do good in our communities and we should do that. And so I just really very much appreciate you doing that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again. And, you know, I might have been doing some things before I showed up on the Auraria campus, but it really did put me on a more direct and intentional course to being more involved in things in the community than I had before. I wasn't really paying attention to that until I got on campus, and I've kept it up ever since.
We lit a fire for you, and I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, we do finish our podcast with three rapid fire questions. So just quick answers, nothing you got to think too hard about, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So the first one, what is your favorite MSU Denver memory?
When I was in student government, Gloria Steinem came to campus, and I was asked by the director of student activities if I would introduce her at her big talk in Tivoli. And I said, well, you know, I don't really know much about her. Maybe I could get an opportunity to talk with her for a few minutes. And Gloria decided that we should have lunch together. So I got to have lunch with her. I asked her for her autograph at the end of that lunch. And she said, I'll give you my autograph if you give me yours, because I think yours is going to be valuable one day.
Oh, that is awesome. And so timely. So David, I don't know if you saw David's reaction. We just, David and our president, Dr. Davidson, and our vice president, they just flew out to Gloria Steinem's house on Monday and did a fireside chat. So a very similar thing, because Gloria is friends with Nancy Gary, who is a big advocate of MSU Denver and supporter, and they're friends. And Nancy was like, oh, you should do a fireside chat, just like a talk with our president, because she's incredible. And Gloria's like, sure, come to my house. So they flew out there. And so David literally just got home yesterday, had to take all of his equipment, so let it up in my office. And so when you said that, I was like, that's incredible. I wish I would have known that, because David could have said when you met her yesterday, like, oh my gosh, I met somebody. And do you still have Xander's autograph, yeah, which is pretty
well,
incredible.
Of course, my name was different when I was there.
That's true. Yeah.
It was Gabriel. I still have the photograph of her and I together that evening of that event. So I could always send it to you and you could be like, you remember this cat?
Please do, because we are going to be sending her a bunch of stuff just to thank her graciously for inviting us into her home and letting us do a live stream fireside chat with her to talk about how, I mean, they were talking a lot about today's political climate and how one person can make a difference, get involved, be an activist and all of that yeah. type of stuff. And so yeah. I definitely will do that. That's so that's incredible. And a great memory, too.
Yeah. Okay. Question two.
Okay. What does it mean to you to be a roadrunner?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, staying quick on your feet, meaning knowing when to pivot, not staying in one place too long, just I don't have to run across the street anymore,
which quite is, literally.
You know, I love the namesake, you know, running back and forth across, what was it, Spear? But, and also go where your feet take you, you know, which I know it sounds like a like an ableist thing, so I don't mean it in that way, but just like be open to where, you know, your feet might take you.
Ah, I love it. All right, last one. If you could put a billboard on campus with a piece of advice for all students to see, what would it say?
It would be to make getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night the number one priority in your life.
That's truth, I tell you. It goes back to what we were chatting about earlier for catastrophic thinking. Then it goes to this and your stress levels go up and your muscles retain, you know, all the things. And people don't realize that sleep can help solve a lot of problems or at least lay a groundwork to give you what you need in order to tackle whatever ahead of you. So I love that.
Yes. You'd probably have to do it in a way that gets people to go, what? Because that's how marketing goes. So I'd probably put up an image about how sleep debt accrues and you never can pay it off. So you might as well stop accruing it now when you're young, you know, to people go, what? Sleep debt? What's that? You know, am I accruing it now? It's like, yes, you are.
Yes, you are. We all are. Yeah, you need that bait that you wouldn't have fallen for, but maybe our students on campus will fall for it. Yeah. Get the clickbait on there. Mm-hmm. Well, this is awesome, Xander. I really, really appreciate your time. And this was very meaningful. And I know that our audience is really going to appreciate your candor, your honesty, openness, and the great discussion that I feel like we had today.
Thank you, Jamie. And thank you, David.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Bird Talk, special accommodation provided by University Advancement. Thank you to Brandy Rideout, production provided by David Sharman, and I'm your host, Jamie Hurst. Keep running, roadies. Have you ever wondered how the magic of Bird Talk is made? Or curious just how many attempts it takes me to read through a bio? Maybe you've wondered about the number of cuss words David has to edit out. Well, come and find out as we host our first ever live Bird Talk on June 27th in Salida, Colorado. The live podcast will be followed by a reception at the Boathouse Cantina. Can't wait to see you there.